It's my pleasure to bring up Dr. Addison May, a professor of surgery at the Carolinas Medical Center in Charlotte, North Carolina, who will be speaking today on antimicrobial options and managing NSTIs.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you very much. Thank you to the moderators for including me and to the college for this opportunity. And thank you to our diehards who've stayed to the very end of the meeting. So I don't really have any relevant financial relationships for this talk. I do receive research funding and consulting fees from Atox Bio, who is the sponsor of the acute trial, a randomized trial, not at antibiotics, but that's an immune modulator. It's about 75% through their enrollment, so hopefully next year we will see results of this particular trial. That's one that Dr. Bulger knows intimately. So first I'd like you to consider this case, if we could. 29-year-old male driver in a high-speed motor vehicle collision. He's partially ejected and pinned in a drainage ditch that's right down from a chicken farm. His injuries include an open distal femur fracture with popliteal artery injury and soft tissue injury. He's given broad-spectrum antibiotics on arrival in the ED and immediately post his after his IND, and in the OR, he undergoes irrigation, debridement, an external fixator, popliteal artery reconstruction, and a four-compartment fasciotomy. Well, within 12 hours, he develops high fever, tachycardia, worsening pulmonary function, and we take him back to the OR emergently for exploration, and at that time, we find a lot of foul-smelling fluid and a necrotizing soft tissue infection despite his broad-spectrum antibiotics. So a couple questions to consider. What do we need to do to help us guide our antibiotic therapy and target this therapy appropriately? And should we change empiric antibiotics? And if so, how should we do this? So getting the right antibiotic therapy started early matters a lot. This is a trial, now old trial, 2006, a retrospective study by Kumar Group. And within this, you see at the bottom the soft tissue infection. This is the odds of mortality with each 1 hour delay in the correct antibiotic therapy. And for the whole group, there was a 12% increase in mortality risk with each 1 hour delay. That's even a little greater for the soft tissue infections. So getting the antibiotics on board early makes a big difference. So my approach to this really, I believe that if you understand sort of the clinical course and the presentation, you can guess pretty accurately what antibiotics you need to start to cover the likely pathogens. But to do that, you really need a basic understanding of the pathophysiology of the interaction between the pathogens and the various tissue planes, and guessing right does make a difference. So our previous speaker had pet peeves. I've got probably more pet peeves than she's got. My first pet peeve is that commonly in the literature, we conflate necrotizing fasciitis with necrotizing soft tissue infection. And I would encourage the audience not to do that, please. So why does that matter? In my opinion, that conflation of the three layers into one entity really makes it hard to understand the pathophysiology. It confounds the inherent resistance of each of those tissue layers and the different infecting organisms that are likely to involve those layers, and limits an in-depth understanding and therefore your approach to antibiotic therapy. So let's talk just briefly about the layers and their intrinsic resistance to infection. The fascial layer really has low resistance to bacterial infection. It's got very tentative blood supply and very poor lymphatic drainage, and therefore becomes ischemic very quickly and allows fluid to collect on both sides, creating a plane where bacteria can spread along that plane fairly unimpeded. This is in contrast to other tissues. The dermis is really part of its job is to exclude bacteria from the rest of our body. So it's got tight junctions and it's actually quite resistant to bacterial invasion if it's healthy. If it's healthy, it's got good blood flow. Muscle typically has very good blood flow, again, if it's healthy, and is resistant to bacterial invasion except for bispecific pathogens. Subcutaneous fat, actually, we all know has pretty cruddy blood flow, but fatty acids and pH inhibit a lot of different bacterial growth. So while eliminating bacteria sitting in fat isn't necessarily straightforward, bacteria frequently don't proliferate that well within fatty tissues. So infections involving the fascial planes can be very indolent and allow low virulent pathogens to spread fairly unimpeded. That's why type 1, and I can't stand the use of the terms type 1. Type 1's okay, but type 2 in past, everybody uses different groupings, and I agree, I don't think it's helpful at all. But type 1, so necrotizing fasciitis, because it's got poor resistance to infection. It accounts, in this country at least, for 70 to 80% of all the necrotizing soft tissue infections. You need broad antibiotic coverage because of the polymicrobial and synergistic nature of these infections, and usually has both anaerobic and aerobic bacteria, as the previous speaker pointed out. And they frequently present with gas and tissues due to anaerobic growth. Remember that anything that is aerobic produces CO2, and CO2 diffuses through a brick. That's why part of the reason why we use it in laparoscopy, it's inert and diffuses well. You can't really get CO2 to collect in tissues. So if you see gas, it means there's anaerobic growth, and obligate aerobes don't produce anaerobic growth. These infections tend to have a much better prognosis than the rapidly progressive and aggressive bacteria that I'll speak about next. So if you have healthy tissue that are resistant to infection and aggressive pathogens, it's a different story. That pathogenesis of those infections really depend on toxin production that enables the bacteria to grow and spread in healthy, viable tissue, and some of those bacteria have a very high proliferation rate as well. The doubling time for Clostridium is 8 minutes, so that's fast growth. So toxins may facilitate spread through healthy, viable skin, such as group A strep and staph, may cause thrombosis and necrosis of previously well-perfused tissues, such as muscle. Clostridium and group A strep both do that. And they can induce systemic activation of inflammation, just a strep toxic shock or staphylococcal toxic shock are good examples of that. These infections can be rapidly progressive, and getting those treated rapidly make a big difference. Typically, the pathogenesis is monomicrobial in origin. They may have multiple pathogens, but the one pathogen with the toxin production really is driving the clinical scenario. So then you really basically, for me, I separate it into two things. You've got mixed polymicrobial soft tissue infections, an average of four or more organisms, the typical perirectal abscess that gets deep into a plane, or a perforated cecal cancer that finally gets into a plane and then starts spreading rapidly along that plane, versus the rapidly progressive infections that are dependent on toxin production, such as group A, sometimes community-acquired, or even standard staphs, Clostridium, and then the gram-negative, such as Vibrio, Aeromonas, Pastorella, and Eikonella. So you've seen these, familiar with that, gas in the tissues rapidly growing. This is the Clostridial myonecrosis, and it invades healthy muscle and releases toxins that cause thrombosis of vessels well ahead of where the bacteria actually is. That's part of the pathogenesis. This is a necrotizing cellulitis. This particular infection didn't involve fascial plane. The skin was dead. The fascia was viable. This is a... You've all seen standard, hey, they say that I got a spider bite. necrotic center. This was inadequately IND'd. This actually, the only thing that grew out was the community acquired MRSA, and it spread along the plains due to the toxins that this organism produces. So for me, I really think about it in two ways. The rapidly progressive infections, I look to see whether they have gas in tissues or no gas in tissues. And really, if it's a rapidly progressive gas in tissues, I'm on gram stain, it will show gram-positive rods, and I'm very worried about clostridial species. The others are pretty much obligate aerobes, of which you have gram-positive cocci, group A strep, and staphs, or gram-negative rods, less frequent, but depending on the scenario. Even in Charlotte and Nashville, we see Vibrio frequently injured in a restaurant preparing food, or they could eat contaminated food that's been brought in. So this is important to separate these two, because the rapidly progressive ones that are producing toxins really do benefit from having protein synthesis inhibitors added to therapy. So for gram-positives, that's clindamycin or perhaps linezolid. They both are antiribosomal agents and inhibit toxin production. At least in lab, they're demonstrated to do that, and in observational studies shown to improve outcome. The gram-negatives, of course, clindamycin and linezolid are obligate gram-positive agents, so you have to use something different for gram-negatives, and that's typically a tetracycline class, and so adding tetracycline, minocycline to this improves outcomes. Now, I do want you to be aware that aminoglycosides also are antiribosomal in activity. Aminoglycosides, of course, have nephrotoxicity, and their penetration into poorly perfused tissues may be suspect, and they don't work well at low pH, so it's unclear about benefits of aminoglycosides in soft tissue infections, and there are no prospective studies. This is just one study that demonstrates in the gram-negatives. On the left, these are Vibrios, and most data from Vibrios comes out of Asia in the countries that are surrounded by water. On the left are patients who only had bacteremia. On the right are patients who had cutaneous infections. And on the left, you can see that actually if a cephalosporin was combined with aminoglycoside, survival was better, but not statistically so. These small numbers. On the right side, it was statistically better in soft tissue infections when you add an aminoglycoside to a third-generation cephalosporin and the treatment of those. Now, other than antiribosomal activity, there may be another reason why combining beta-lactams with another agent improve outcomes. And this may be due to what's called the Eagle effect. It's been known for a long time. Harry Eagle in 1952 demonstrated that when you have a high inoculum, such as Strep pyogenes myositis, that there's a lot of static bacteria. These are cell wall agents, and they do not kill in static phase. So there's a downregulation of the penicillin binding proteins, and a lot of bacteria are not dividing. And so you will have clinical failures to beta-lactams in very high inocula-type disease processes. This has also been demonstrated, at least in laboratory animals and models, with Clostridium and staph, and is believed to probably exist as well, but less data for that with gram-negative organisms. So my approach, if there's a non-rapidly progressive, typically your type 1 necrotizing fasciitis, polymicrobial, you may have MRSA involved. So single or combination broad-spectrum antibiotics, plus or minus any MRSA coverage. For the rapidly progressive organisms, you need dual coverage, adding an antiribosomal agent to a beta-lactam. Again, for the gram-positives, you'll want clindamycin or linezolid. For the gram-negatives, you'll want tetracycline class. So you need to know whether it's a gram-positive or a gram-negative organism. Well, what particular antibiotics? There are two guidelines out there. The SIS one's currently being updated. The IDSA came out in 2014 with their update. There's not a whole lot new for broad-spectrum coverage. They both recommend the possibility of piperacillin, tazobactam, the carbapenems, as well as tigecycline. There are a number of combination agents that are available. We typically would try to use a single agent if we could, rather than exposing to multiple classes for our broad-spectrum coverage. I would point out that the increasing resistance among Enterobacteriaceae, particularly E. coli, for ampicillin-bactam and cipro and levofloxacin would limit their empiric use. A significant portion of standard pathogens are now resistant to those agents, so would not use them alone in broad-spectrum coverage. Definitive therapy for specific pathogens, at least recommended in the guidelines, and there's not really any data beyond those guidelines. For if you know it's a prototypical group A strep and you're confident with a group A strep, then high-dose penicillin plus clindamycin, both in high doses. Though, actually, piperacillin and carbapenems have great coverage against streps. So if you're not sure and you're on that, you may de-escalate to a narrower agent or continue if you're not sure with one of your broad-spectrum agents. MSSA, high-dose anti-staphylococcal penicillins, nafcillin, oxacillin. It drives me nuts that there's a sick patient and ID recommends cephalosporins because the penicillins, anti-staphylococcal penicillins, are known to outperform cephalosporins in this situation. So I would treat with a anti-staphylococcal penicillin, and if they're septic, I would add an antiribosomal agent as well. Clostridium, very similar to group A strep, high-dose penicillin plus clindamycin. Again, zosyn and carbapenems have great coverage, so you don't need to worry about adding penicillin to them if you're doing that. The virulent gram-negatives, typically third-generation cephalosporins or the carbapenems, maybe fluoroquinolones, but you better know your local sensitivities, and these are rare enough that you probably won't know your local sensitivities. But again, in combination with antiribosomal agent, tetracycline class drug. There's several options for specifically targeting community-acquired MRSA that have been approved for complicated soft tissue infections. Hardly any of these have clear data for necrotizing infections, but they are used with some regularity. The most common two would be linezolid and vancomycin. And I'll speak a little bit more about the comparison of those two. There's a new agent that's sort of the next generation linezolid that has been approved. At present, most of the studies are equivalence studies. I'm not sure we have that on our even on our pharmacy list. So wouldn't be a first-line agent now. Daptomycin has been proven to be effective. We've mentioned clindamycin, but I will give one hesitancy for using Clinda by itself because of resistance, and then there are some other agents that I will touch just briefly. In meta-analyses, linezolid outperforms vancomycin. It's not dramatically so. But I would not be hesitant to use linezolid in this setting, and you may consider it your first-line agent. If you are using linezolid, you have to remember that thrombocytopenia is a complication, particularly if you're extending therapy, and so monitoring platelet counts is needed. There's some new agents that you ought to at least know about that have been approved for complicated soft tissue infections, but none of these would I consider as treatment of choice in necrotizing infections, at least to date. Tadalafil has several randomized studies, although of these are equivalency studies at present, showing that it's as good as linezolid may turn out to be better. The other newer agents that are approved There's some long-acting glycopeptides. You dose them once. You don't need to dose them again. But the pharmacokinetics and all in very sick patients are really not known. And once you've dosed it, you can't get rid of it. So risk of nephrotoxicity is unclear. There's ceftaroline, a broad agent that has both good gram-positive MRSA and gram-negative activity. Most institutions are sort of limiting these new agents for targeting specific settings where you have a problem with resistance so that you're not using those a good bit. And the last point I want to make is that clindamycin resistance is becoming an issue. And so using clindamycin alone in a severe infection should be done with some hesitancy. As much as 30% of community-acquired MRSA are resistant to clindamycin. It's sometimes hard to detect because it's got inducible resistance that wouldn't be seen without specific test. So just back to our particular patient. This patient underwent debridement. On gram stain, we demonstrated gram-negative rods, so we added minocycline. The patient went back to the OR, and the tissue was it had so much loss of tissue that underwent an amputation. Cultures revealed Aeromonas and two other pathogens. The predominant pathogen by far and away was the Aeromonas hydrophilia, being outside of a chicken farm is not to your advantage, I would guess. And with that, I thank you for your attention.